Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We're smack in the middle of this gigantic mortgage lending and housing mess, right? Yet today, the 800-pound subprime gorilla, the featured player in the whole thing, says its future looks just fine. And get this, Wall Street falls for it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. And by Vanguard, offering 529 plans for those thinking about saving for college at Vanguard.com/529.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, everybody, the 26th of October. Good to have you with us. Wall Street bid into Countrywide today, hook, line, and sinker. This country's biggest mortgage lender said this morning it lost more than $1 billion in the quarter just ended. But founder and CEO Angelo Mozzillo also said the black ink's going to start flowing again this quarter and that he thinks Countrywide's better off than any other mortgage company out there. By the convoluted logic of the stock market, that turned into a 32% spike in Countrywide stock today. We asked Marketplace's Steve Tripoli to see whether the people bidding up those shares have been drinking more than their fair share of the Kool-Aid.
Countrywide executives say a $1.2 billion third quarter loss is the big hit that will set the company right. Tom LaMalfa of Wholesale Access Research and Consulting sells mortgage industry research to Countrywide. Count him among the skeptics about that claim.
I think such an assessment really isn't supported by the facts about the mortgage mess and about how Countrywide specifically can extricate itself from its fate.
Countrywide boss Angelo Mozzillo would disagree. He said in a statement today that the company is building up cash and tightening underwriting guidelines. Mozzillo says those fixes plus thousands of job cuts are setting things right. Not so fast, says Tom LaMalfa.
I think that they have hidden in their portfolio all kinds of problems that have not yet surfaced.
Problems with asset valuation, the quality of loans, and what it will cost to resolve those two. Not everyone's a skeptic. Just about every Countrywide analyst on the planet was tied up in an hours-long conference call with Countrywide this afternoon. But here are some of their comments from earlier today as read by Marketplace staff members.
We're still working through the model, and we have a lot of questions. However, on the surface, this is positive.
Countrywide moved decisively to reorient its business model, so that should help it once the mortgage market starts to recover.
Countrywide's problems won't work themselves out in a period of months, but the industry will be around 3 or 4 years from now, and Countrywide will be more valuable.
The stock's already more valuable. It was bid up all afternoon by investors who want to believe the company's fourth quarter optimism. But should they believe? That's hard to say. Countrywide's recent pronouncements about how it's weathering the subprime storm it helped create have been pretty consistently of the rose-colored variety. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
It's been a week of ugly reminders about the state of the credit market and the lingering effects of the subprime thing. Countrywide today, as Steve was telling us, Merrill Lynch with an $8 billion credit-related write-down earlier this week. But never fear, because Wall Street's got a plan. Some big investment banks, with the encouragement of Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, have set up what's come to be called a super fund. The basic idea is to backstop some of those complicated structured finance deals and keep things liquid. Today, John Snow, who used to run the Treasury Department, said he thinks that fund isn't really going to work, which leads us to ask, why not? James Saft is a columnist for Reuters. Mr. Saft, hello.
Hello.
It's not officially called a super fund. I guess it's called something else. But remind us how it's supposed to work.
Well, it's supposed to be a fund that buys a number of assets that have been distressed and have been difficult to trade from other funds that the bank set up earlier. And the banks are worried that these other funds are going bad and that they will be forced to buy the loans back on their own balance sheets.
Seems to me that these banks are sort of on both sides of the fence, right? They've made these investments in subprimes and all the structured investment vehicles and funds that are out there. And yet now they're also starting this super fund that they're hoping is going to solve the whole thing.
I think that's exactly right. And that's because it would be very painful to go down the other options that are available to them. If they go out into the market and they say, we have these structured vehicles, we have these complicated bonds, and we want to sell them, the price that they're going to get, especially because there's so much of it that they'd be all trying to sell at the same time, would be very low. And that's going to hit those banks. It's going to hit their balance sheets, and it's going to hit their ability to loan to everybody else who might need money. On the other hand, if they do what they're proposing to do, which is to set up a kind of club which will create a new vehicle and buy these loans, some of the loans, at a stated price, which is not so bad, the problem there is that it doesn't give everybody else a confidence that that's a real price. If you've got Citibank, for example, who's affiliated with some of the funds that are selling, and Citibank, on the other hand, which is affiliated with the funds that are buying. It just doesn't seem as if it's the same thing as a New York Stock Exchange quotation where one person comes in and buys from another person and they're not in business together or affiliated.
And here we have former Treasury Secretary Snow this morning saying, you know what, this fund is only delaying the inevitable, that the market's eventually going to work itself all out. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I tend to agree. There isn't any easy way out. And if you take one bank and it buys a bit of the loan from another bit of the bank, which is essentially what we're talking about, that doesn't convince me that it's produced a real price that I myself might want to invest at. The banks have too much of an interest in these loans, in these vehicles, being priced at a high level so they don't have to take losses. And if they go ahead with this thing, what it won't do is it won't allow everybody else in the marketplace to confidently go out and say, I know I've got an asset that's like this and it's worth, let's say, 95 or 90 cents on the dollar.
What I hear you saying is that really they're being incredibly short-sighted, that they're not really understanding what's going to happen in the long run out of this fund and the whole rest of this mess.
I'm not sure that that's fair. I think that they probably understand what would happen and that is going to be painful for them particularly and holds risks for the economy in specific, but that there isn't a great other alternative that can get them out of that situation. I don't think that they're foolish. I don't think that they're short-sighted. I think they're simply in a really tight corner.
James Saft is a columnist for Reuters based out of London. Mr. Saft, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Oil's up, a record. The dollar's down, also a record. But hey, so what? We'll have the happy music and the whole week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. Have you noticed how your neighborhood grocery store isn't really just a grocery store anymore? All the big chains seem to have gone upscale with premium this and specialty that, and woe to the competitor who doesn't keep up. Which is why the Dutch supermarket conglomerate Royal Ahold announced today it's going to renovate 100 of its giant food stores here in the United States. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports the facelifts are long overdue.
Ask shoppers streaming into a Whole Foods near downtown Washington, D.C. what they think of a nearby giant supermarket.
Not much.
I have not shopped there in years.
Quality of food, it's not good.
And you see why Giant's market share has taken a beating in the last few years. Mark Hamstra at Supermarket News says Giant, which operates in the Mid-Atlantic, and other older chains like Safeway are all feeling a pinch.
Chains came in that were a little bit more upscale, a little bit smarter in their marketing.
Now, mid-market chains like Giant are caught in an intense two-front war for market share. They're trying to compete for yuppie dollars by adding gourmet cheese counters, while at the same time competing with discounters like Walmart and Costco. To make matters worse, Hamstra says in 2003 a billion-dollar accounting scandal consumed Royal Ahold's executives.
The Enron of the Netherlands.
for years, they didn't invest in spiffing up their American stores.
Giant, I think, got caught with its feet in the sand.
Today, the company's books are back in order, and new leaders are trying to right the ship at Giant Food. The biggest move to date is a decision to spend unspecified millions upgrading Giant's shop-worn stores. Jamie Miller is Giant's public affairs manager.
It's actually the largest investment that Ahold's made in Giant stores.
Hamstra at Supermarket News says this move may help stop the bleeding at Giant, but the company still has a long way to go. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The United Nations issued its fourth annual Global Environmental Outlook this week, and the outlook is dire. Scientists at the UN say that if we, that is humans, keep consuming natural resources the way we're used to, many ecosystems will be driven past the point of no return. Fresh water is right at the top of that list. You need look no further than the Southeast United States, where many towns and cities, including Atlanta, are months away from simply running out of water. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports the economic fallout is only beginning.
Last weekend, Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue declared a state of emergency for 85 counties. Then on Tuesday, he mandated a 10% reduction in the state's water use. Georgia and much of the Southeast are months into what's being called the worst drought in the region's history, which has many wondering why regulators have waited so long to react.
Measures like that should have been taken really years ago.
Gil Rogers is with the Southern Environmental Law Center. He says Atlanta, for example, has the smallest city watershed in the country, despite being one of the nation's fastest-growing metro areas.
We were getting to a point where we're straining our water resources, regardless of whether there's a drought or not.
That strain has now reached a crisis point. Charles Krautler heads the Atlanta Regional Commission, the planning agency in charge of water use. He says the agency has done its best to balance water restrictions against economic needs.
It's a fine line because Metro Atlanta is the biggest economy in the Southeast, and we need to assure that the economy continues to function and that people have the water that they need for their daily uses.
Krautler says the limited amount of water Atlanta is allowed to draw from its reservoir based on endangered species laws is already costing business. One measure limiting water use by landscaping companies has cost them about 14,000 jobs since June and more than $1 billion in lost revenue. Mary Kay Woodworth with the Metro Atlanta Landscape and Turf Association says her industry has been unfairly singled out.
It's hard to say that it's fairly allocated when no other consumer has been asked or mandated to stop using water.
The region's big industrial users like Coca-Cola have yet to face any limits on water use. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Time to check the week on Wall Street with stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. I'll tell you, David, it feels like weeks since we've spoken, you and I.
It has been weeks since we've spoken, you and I. But, you know, in human years, I guess it is just 2 weeks. But, boy, in stock market, it's like a decade.
Yeah, no joke.
This is another one of those weeks where you say, you know, you just throw it against the wall and say, just see if it sticks. There was no reason for this week at all. We ended this week with decent gains, what, 2% or something in the Dow and S&P, 3% in the NASDAQ. You look at it, it was a perfect storm. It was, you know, close to $100 oil, and you've got sanctions, and, you know, Iran's going nuts, and Caterpillar's talking recession, and there's a credit crunch, and my goodness, Merrill wrote off $8 billion?
So make some sense of it for me, man.
I guess they're looking beyond that. I don't know. There are a lot of individual stories that are out there. The biggest story for the week has to be technology.
Mm-hmm.
This technology stocks, for a lot of individual reasons, just took off. Now part of it is, and it's very legitimate, and I'm sorry to have to bring this globalization thing up again to you. But these guys are really global. 80% of Intel's earnings come from outside of the United States. I talked to a guy from TI, from Texas Instruments, this week when they came with their numbers. 85% of theirs come offshore. So to some great degree, they're immune from this, you know, this downturn, and don't get hurt In fact, it helped when the dollar just gets pounded. But the other thing, you know, the other thing what? That really gets your blood going yeah. on Wall Street is rumors and whispers.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Oh.
There are some good ones out there, though.
And there were some bad ones, too.
Well, that's equally true.
And there were some that are up. Well, this AIG, this rumor that AIG, the big insurance company, uh-huh. was going to be the next one to make a Merrill Lynch type write-off. That killed us the other day for a little while.
But which, A, has yet to happen, but B, still might happen.
Well, and it might happen. And then there was this rumor that the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee might meet and cut interest rates sooner than later instead of waiting until
next week. Yeah, that was me.
Next week.
I planted that one.
Did you really?
I did, yeah.
Well, I didn't want you to preempt because it's not very often that you have Halloween and the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee meeting on the same day.
I hadn't even thought about that one.
And that's what we have. But, you know, we treat rumors differently on Wall Street, I think, than what you'd call legitimate journalists do.
Well, that's a little scary because, you know, people make real decisions based on what they hear on, you know, us and CNBC and all those other things.
Well, but the whole key is to take a note. It's not okay to start a rumor. But
right,
what you do is you elevate a rumor so that everybody at least knows the status. You don't have some people who think they know something and the others are just, what's going on? Why is that happening?
Yeah, but see, then there's this herd mentality thing that happens.
Oh, yeah, then there's that.
Yeah,
but that's Wall Street.
Oh, lovely.
That's why it's bulls instead of rattlesnakes or something.
David Johnson down in Dallas. Thank you, David.
Have a good weekend, Kyle.
All right, you too. Coming up, the cloak and dagger business of Halloween.
Unlike on the permanent side, where you actually know where your competitor is, in our world, you don't know where your competitor is until everybody opens up their doors.
Or maybe that's just a rumor. I don't know. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 1% today, about 134 points to close at 13,806. The NASDAQ moved up 1.9%, 53 points to close at 2804. The S&P 500 gained 1.3%, 20 points to end the day at 1535. For the week gone by, the Dow up more than 2%. The NASDAQ rose 2.9%. The S&P 500 picked up 2.3%. Sales of the new Halo 3 video game were heavenly for Microsoft in the third quarter. Shares of the software giant shot up 9.5% today. That after yesterday's news of a 23% rise in profits. Merrill Lynch climbed 8.5% today on news that CEO Stan O'Neill may possibly be getting a pink slip. We don't know. Internet companies fared well. Yahoo soared 7.3%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.4%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. By the American Academy of Family Physicians, personal preventive care for better patient health and reduce costs for business. AAFP.org/value. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth. Marketplace is podcasting. Marketplace Takeout is a mix of our best stories from the past week, the cream of the crop from our reporters around the world, delivered to you on the go wherever you are. Want to sign up? Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link at the top of the page. Or you can download entire shows of Marketplace and Marketplace Money at audible.com.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Monday. The American Bar Association discusses the state of the death penalty at the National Press Club. The 30th International Public ICANN meeting gets underway in Los Angeles. The Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers oversees domain names and addresses around the world. And October 29th is the anniversary of Black Tuesday, a devastating day for Wall Street in 1929. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. So there I was watching the World Series last night when a marketing gimmick interrupted a perfectly good ball game.
No throw down, a stolen base for Jacoby Ellsbury at second and third, two out. And with that stolen base, Jacoby Ellsbury just won America a free taco from Taco Bell. Visit a participating Taco Bell on October 30th from 2 to 5 p.m. to get your free taco.
But wait, there's more, because you've seen those fans in the bleachers who hold up all those signs, right? Fox and Chevrolet have taken the art of the homemade banner one step further. During Game 1 Wednesday night, Fox cameras zoomed in on one such sign with a superimposed digital image of the Chevy logo. Announcer Joe Buck, who you just heard, read the obligatory "This game brought to you by" thing. But here's the great part. The crowd shot was filmed last week. Chevy brought a couple of dozen extras into Fenway Park, filmed the scene with the sign, which Fox then spliced into the live broadcast Wednesday. But to you and me watching at home, looked like just another sponsorship cutaway. So don't believe everything you see, I guess. Anyway, on the field last night, the Sox squeaked out a win. They lead the series 2-0 now. Commentator Glenn Rifkin says, just like Chevy, the Sox have been polishing up their brand.
During the eighth inning of every Red Sox game at Fenway Park, 37,000 Sox fans join in a full-throated roar of Neil Diamond's Sweet Caroline. The catchy anthem's been played at Fenway since 1998, but most Sox fans associate it with the team's World Series victory of 2004. Oddly enough, 2004 changed the Red Sox brand. For Red Sox Nation, the eternal frustration at coming close but never winning had, over the decades, become a distinctive brand attribute. Loyalty to the Sox meant, wait till next year. But then, in 2004, the Red Sox, with their cowboy up mantra, dispatched the hated Yankees in a monster comeback, then swept the Cardinals in the World Series. 86 years of futility was erased. But a vexing new question emerged. How would winning impact the brand? Would fans who were loyal to futility switch that loyalty to success? From a brand perspective, the answer has been a resounding yes, and here's why. Red Sox ownership viscerally understands the rituals and traditions that have long been the bedrock of the brand. They kept the team in Fenway Park, that baseball shrine, and remade it into the crown jewel of ballparks. They put a winning product on the field every season. They celebrate the colorful players, from long-haired Johnny Damon in 04 to river-dancing Jonathan Papelbon this season. They even brought back Kevin Millar, Mr. Cowboy Up himself, from the 2004 squad, to throw out the first pitch before Game 7 in the ALCS. And they've expanded their New England fan base to become baseball's top-drawing road team and a ratings bonanza for postseason broadcasts. Despite grumbling that the Red Sox are beginning to emulate Steinbrenner's Yankees, the brand has retained its cachet, not unlike the Grateful Dead or Harley Davidson, with their huge communities of devoted fans. In a brand sense, the Sox have become the Mac of baseball to the Yankees' PC. The brand may have been born from futility, but success has made the good times better than ever.
Glenn Rifkin's a business writer based in the Boston area. He's also the co-author of the book Radical Marketing, From Harvard to Harley. If you're following the series, or even if you're not, drop us a line. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org and click on the link that says Contact. A note now from yesterday's broadcast. In a commentary on European defense spending, we said the Eurofighter is a Franco-German production. In fact, it's made by a German, Spanish, British, and Italian consortium. You're going to be hearing a lot of this next week, followed shortly thereafter by a whole lot of this.
Trick-or-treat.
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 I love that second and last one, the trick-or-treat, like it's a question. Some of you are probably heading out to Halloween parties this weekend and scrambling to scare up a costume. Luckily, there's an entire industry devoted to helping out the procrastinators among you. Fly-by-night costume shops land in empty storefronts about this time every year. They hawk their hats and their brooms, and by the time November rolls around, they've disappeared. Marketplace's Caitlin Carroll reports the amount of cash they take with them is almost frightening.
Customers paw through layers of scary masks and ghoulish decorations at the Spirit Halloween store in Burbank, California. This is just one of more than 500 stores Spirit Halloween opens every fall. Employee Vanessa Sands says there's plenty of demand for the usual items.
Lots of pirates. Lots of pirates this year. And lots of just bloody things.
You want to be a sexy pirate? $29.99. Crop the top and add some feathers, and you can be a scandalous pirate for $119.99. Scott Krugman from the National Retail Federation says 18 to 34-year-olds spend more on costumes like this every year. And all this for what's really a small holiday. Halloween sales are only expected to bring in about $5 billion. Compare that to Christmas, which is worth almost 100 times that. Still, Krugman says big box retailers like Target and Walmart want a piece of the action.
I think retailers are doing a much better job of recognizing trends and adapting. They're seeing more adults spend on the holiday, and they're, in turn, offering more elaborate merchandise.
The invasion of the big box stores is bad news for the specialty outfits. Chains like Spirit already have their hands full competing for prime store locations with other specialty retailers, says Spirit Halloween executive Tony Detze.
Unlike on the permanent side, where you actually know where your competitor is, in our world, you don't know where your competitor is until everybody opens up their doors.
Detze says nailing down spots for the shops is hard enough. Staffing them can be a nightmare. He goes from overseeing 43 permanent employees during the year to 10,000 near the holiday. They get paid minimum wage or slightly above, and Detze finds them by placing ads on Craigslist and Monster.com, appropriately. Let's see, temporary workers, temporary stores, relatively low wages. It almost makes them sound like carnies.
We get called that quite a bit, that we're carnival people, that we only come in to set up the tent and then leave. But we consider ourselves operating a permanent business on a temporary basis.
Employees in Burbank don't seem to mind their tent status. Some of them are Spirit's best customers. Vanessa Sands is checking out a Little Red Riding Hood costume in her off time.
Usually I'm a fairy or something fully covered or a nurse, but I figure I'll go sexy this year. I'm 30. It's dirty 30, I guess.
Whether it's sexy or sweet, Halloween shoppers have plenty of options. Costume companies like Spirit Halloween, Halloween Adventure, and Halloween Express are busting at the seams. Because even though this isn't the biggest holiday, everyone knows that it's still the most thrilling. In Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org. By Reuters, the world's daily news and information source. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note before you go today. We learned the other day Microsoft had bought a stake in Facebook, $240 million for 1.5%, which values the social networking site at a staggering $15 billion. Kind of leaves Rupert Murdoch's $550 million for MySpace looking like a bargain. There's a conference today up in San Francisco for Facebook programmers, Facebook only, by the way, folks that build widgets that go inside social networking pages. Gerardo Capiel was there. He's the founder of a startup called Gidget. And we called him just to check on the mood to see how people are feeling about dot-coms today.
The level of excitement reminds me a lot of the level of excitement that there was back in 1996, 1997.
Yeah, if you're thinking bubble, that's exactly what crossed our minds, too. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow jumped 134 points, 1%. The NASDAQ roared ahead 53 points, 1.9%. The S&P 500 added 20 points, 1.3% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up on the program Monday, investors decide if nuclear power is a big deal or just a bad deal.
The Congressional Budget Office estimated back in 2003 a 50% default rate on construction of new reactors.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.